Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Duty of Prudence Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 25th, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Amgen Inc. v. Harris without oral argument. Former employees of an Amgen subsidiary had participated in a benefit plan that offered ownership of Amgen stock. When the value of Amgen stock fell in 2007, stockholders filed a class action against plan fiduciaries alleging a breach of fiduciary duties, including the duty of prudence, under the Employer Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. Although the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit initially reversed a district court decision dismissing the class action complaint, the U.S. Supreme Court then vacated the Ninth Circuit's judgment and remanded the case in light of the Supreme Court's then-recent decision, Fifth Third Bancorp v. Dudenhofer, which set forth the standards for stating a claim for breach of the duty of prudence against fiduciaries who manage employee stock ownership plans. On remand, the Ninth Circuit reiterated its conclusion that the plaintiff's complaint stated a claim for breach of fiduciary duty, and the Supreme Court again granted certiorari. In a per curiam opinion, the court reversed the judgment of the Ninth Circuit by a vote of 9-0, holding that the court had failed to properly evaluate the complaint. In its current form, the Supreme Court concluded the complaint failed to state a claim for breach of the duty of prudence. In remanding the case, however, the court indicated that the district court could decide in the first instance whether the stockholders might amend their complaint in order to adequately plead a claim for breach of the duty of prudence. To discuss the case, we have George T. Conway III, who is partner, litigation, at Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Conway.
Harris against Amgen, which was decided by the Supreme Court on January 25, is what we securities litigators call an ERISA stock drop case. Now, you've probably heard of regular securities class actions, which are cases brought by shareholders under the federal securities laws against public companies whose stock prices have dropped, and the claim there is that defendants committed fraud by misstating or failing to disclose material information to the market. Well, an ERISA stock drop case is somewhat similar in that it often follows a drop in a public company stock price. But it's brought under ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. And the plaintiffs are employees of the company who are participants in ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans. ESOPs are these investment vehicles that you may have heard of that many companies have created that allow employees to invest some of their retirement assets in their company stock. And Congress in ERISA actually sought to encourage companies to create ESOPs because Congress believed, as a matter of public policy, that employee stock ownership is a good thing. Now, in an ERISA stock drop class action, the defendants are typically officers of the company who are serving as fiduciaries of the ESOP. And the claim is that these people breached their fiduciary duties under ERISA because they knew something bad about the company that would cause its stock to drop, but they failed to take steps to protect the ESOP participant by, for example, halting investments in the ESOP and stopping company stock purchases, or by disclosing the negative information so that participants would know not to invest. The lower federal court struggled for many years with how to handle this kind of litigation. And the problem was, it's very easy to allege this sort of claim because there isn't any heightened pleading standard that you can use to screen out meritless cases. In the securities realm, you have Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 9B and the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995, both of which require securities fraud to be pled with great particularity. But there is nothing like that under ERISA, and the lower courts thought, well, that's a problem because Congress explicitly sought to encourage ESOPs. The thinking of these lower courts was, well, if we allow too many of these cases to proceed, we'd be undermining that important congressional policy favoring ESOPs. So several federal courts of appeals adopted something called the Mensch presumption, and that's named after a 1995 Third Circuit case called Mensch against Robertson. And what Mensch held was that ESOP fiduciaries would be presumed to have acted prudently in allowing employees to invest in company stock. And the presumption under Mensch was pretty strong. Essentially, you you could only state a claim if you were an ESOP participant if the company was on the brink of collapse. Now, that very strong defense-friendly presumption came to an end in 2014 when the Supreme Court completely rejected Mensch by a 9-0 vote. And it did that in a case called Fifth Third against Dudenhofer. In Fifth Third, the Supreme Court looked at the text of ERISA and said, we don't see anything about a presumption in here, so there isn't one. What we see, the court held, is a statute that says ERISA fiduciaries have to act prudently under the facts and circumstances. The only exception for ESOPs, the court found, was one textually based one that says that ESOP fiduciaries are relieved of the duty to diversify investments, which of course makes sense for ESOPs because ESOPs only invest in one thing. So other than that, the court held, there's no special rule or presumption that treats ESOP fiduciaries any differently from other ERISA fiduciaries. Now that would seem to be bad news for ESOP fiduciaries, but it actually didn't turn out so bad for them because the court went on in its opinion to essentially say to ESOP fiduciaries, we feel your pain. The court said, we understand how fiduciaries can find themselves between, quote, a rock and a hard place, close quote. And although they could be sued for being imprudent if they allowed participants to continue to invest, but the stock then went down, and then they could be sued the other way for violating the plan if they stop investments and then the stock actually goes up. So the court said, you know, we understand that meritless, costly lawsuits could undermine the congressional policy encouraging ESOPs, but there's just not a presumption that you can use to address that problem. But the court went on to explain there was a way to weed out meritless cases by applying Twombly and Iqbal on a motion to dismiss. It said that whether there was a breach of the fiduciary duty of prudence under ERISA was a fact-sensitive question, and district courts had to scrutinize ERISA complaints carefully under Twombly and Iqbal to make sure that a breach was properly pleaded. And in particular, the court held that a plaintiff couldn't state a claim simply by saying that ESOP fiduciaries breached their fiduciaries by failing to act on public information about a company's stock. Fiduciaries, the court held, are generally entitled to presume that the market price of a stock already takes public information into account. And that left then inside information, non-public information, which was a bit trickier. And there the court held that a plaintiff had to allege that the fiduciary, the ESOP fiduciary, could have taken some alternative action, like shutting down the fund or closing it, or disclosing the non-public information, that the fiduciary could have taken some alternative action like that that was both A, consistent with the securities laws, and B, something that a prudent fiduciary, would not have viewed as being more likely to harm the fund than to help the fund. Well, you know, what does that mean? The court went on to make 3 points to explain. First, it said the ERISA duty of prudence doesn't require fiduciaries to violate laws, and that includes the securities laws. So if acting on the inside information meant violating the insider trading laws, well, then the ERISA plaintiff can't state a claim by saying that the defendant should have done that. Secondly, the court emphasized in Fifth Third that the lower courts had to consider whether or not the alternative action proposed by the plaintiffs would have otherwise conflicted with the complex disclosure rules that govern public companies. And third, and this is pretty important, the lower court had to consider, according to the Supreme Court in Fifth Third, whether the alternative action, again like closing investments or disclosure, could harm the fund. For example, if the fiduciaries shut down the ESOP, well, people outside are going to say, oh, why'd they do that? That must mean there's something really wrong with the company, and the stock would go down, and that would hurt the ESOP and the ESOP participants because the value of the ESOP would go down. So the Supreme Court said that the lower courts had to, quote, consider whether the complaint has plausibly alleged that a prudent fiduciary in the defendant's position could not have concluded that stopping purchases or publicly disclosing negative information would do more harm than good to the fund by causing a drop in the stock price. In essence, the plaintiff had to come up with particular facts to show that a reasonable fiduciary could not have possibly concluded that if we pull the plug on the ESOP or if we disclose this information, that would cause the stock to go down and that would hurt the fund. And that's a pretty tall order. And that brings us finally to Harris against Amgen. That was an ERISA stock drop case originally dismissed by a district court in California under Mensch. But then in 2013, before Fifth Third, the Ninth Circuit reversed, holding that Mensch, for various reasons, didn't apply. And the defendants then petitioned for cert, and their case was held for Fifth Third. And then after Fifth Third came down in 2014, the court granted the cert petition and vacated and remanded the case to the Ninth Circuit for reconsideration in light of Fifth Third. The problem was that the Ninth Circuit essentially reissued its opinion, its pre-Fifth Third opinion, with just a few changes. And it pretty much, in doing that, pretty much ignored Fifth Third. The Ninth Circuit panel basically said there was no conflict, really no conflict between ERISA and the federal securities laws, because if you disclose the inside information or you stop purchases, you're really complying with both statutes. And then the Court of Appeals came pretty close to saying that a fiduciary could never conclude that stopping purchases or publicly disclosing the negative information could do more harm than good to the fund, because, the Ninth Circuit said, stock's ultimately going to drop anyway at some point if there's this problem, this negative information that's ultimately going to come out. And that triggered a very, very strong en banc dissent, or from a dissent from a denial of a petition for rehearing en banc from Judge Kaczynski. And then Amgen petitioned for cert again, and this time it asked for summary reversal. And it got it, which is an extraordinary thing, because the Supreme Court really only summarily reverses when its decisions are basically being completely ignored or misapplied by a lower court. And the court in Amgen issued a very short, extremely short, four-page per curiam opinion that was unanimous. The Supreme Court held that the Ninth Circuit had failed to apply Fifth Third because the Ninth Circuit had, quote, failed to assess whether the complaint has plausibly alleged that a prudent fiduciary in the same position could not have concluded that the alternative action, such as closing the fund or disclosure, would do more harm than good, close quote. Essentially, it recapitulated the standard of Fifth Third and said the Ninth Circuit didn't apply it. And then the Ninth Circuit sent the case straight back to the district court, and it bypassed the Ninth Circuit. The court reviewed the complaint itself, the Supreme Court, and held that it found had not found sufficient facts and allegations to state a claim for the breach of the duty of prudence under Fifth Third. And then the court sent the case back to the district court, again bypassing the Ninth Circuit, for the district court to decide whether plaintiffs would be allowed to amend their complaint to try to satisfy Fifth Third. And that's it. Just a couple of paragraphs, short and sweet, Harris against Amgen. Essentially, the court said, we really meant what we said in Fifth Third.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.